Good afternoon from Aspen Public Radio. I'm Allison Bechtesh. This is Airtime, extended conversations with interesting people. Today, an in-depth look into the investigative piece by NPR and Frontline titled, "An Epidemic is Killing Thousands of Coal Miners. Regulators Could Have Stopped It." We'll be speaking with reporter Howard Berkus. He spent years speaking with coal miners and regulators as rates of black lung disease continue to increase in the U.S. It's more fatal, and it's showing up in younger workers. The full investigative report ran last week on All Things Considered. It opens with a montage of voices, coal miners who have black lung disease. I asked him about the decision to start his report there.
Well, you know, it's interesting. We interviewed 34 coal miners for this story. That's a lot of interviews. And so many of them had so many amazing descriptions of how the disease affects them, what it has done to their lives, how they interact with their family members, especially grandkids, the things they can't do anymore. Plus, we also asked them about what the conditions were like in the mines they worked in and how those conditions changed over time. And of course, that was relevant to our story as well. What kind of coal mine dust exposure, especially exposure from silica dust, that they had over time? What kind of cheating might have occurred in the mine when mine inspectors showed up and were trying to get honest samples of the dust? So we had so many great interviews, and the miners were so generous with their time and so forthcoming. And in many cases, they were talking about, you know, really tragic circumstances, especially in affecting their lives. These are people, as one pulmonologist we spoke to said, are essentially suffocating while alive. They are going to die from this disease, and it's an unpleasant death. And so that's why I wanted to ground the story in the lives of the people who are suffering from this disease. And that was, I felt, a really good way to do it, by bringing in these multiple voices. And there's also power in that. You can talk about data all you want. And we have tons of data, reams of data. But what really makes the story important is how real people are affected. And in this case, it's a disease, and how that has ruined their lives is a critical part of understanding why anybody should care about this story.
We think of reporters as going into scenes with a pen and a paper and getting the facts and then turning those facts into a story. You had so many human moments, though, in your writing in this piece. I'm wondering if you can talk a little bit about the signs you got beyond just the interview, beyond just the information. And what I'm thinking of is there's coughing on the tape that the listener has to sit through. How many times as a reporter did you have to sit through your source struggling to breathe? And what did that inform you that they could have never told you, you know, with words? Or this phrase you had, one of the coal miners, his sunglasses hid the tears. You know, that's something I, as a listener, I kind of needed that picture. And then I start crying. You know, how much did you learn, not from what was said, but by actually spending time with your sources?
I got to tell you that a reporter who just is a stenographer, writes down a set of facts and then repeats them, is not necessarily conveying the story in a way that's meaningful. Because it isn't just the facts that matter, it's how human beings, how real people are affected by the whatever it is you're talking about, the issue, the event. And so to me, what was always most important, first and foremost, is not just what the data said or the facts said, but how those things have changed people's lives. So in this case, it was important for me to portray as much as possible the way that this disease affects these miners. And so you hear it in their breathing. You hear it in the labored breath that they have. You heard it in the case of Danny Smith, as he's trying to do something as simple as mowing his lawn. And he only goes 15 feet, and he nearly collapses, and he bends over, and he not only starts coughing and hacking, he spits up dead lung tissue, pieces of his lung.
Were you there when that happened?
Well, you heard it, right? I was there, yeah, of course. Yeah, I was with him, and he stopped mowing, and he bent down and yeah, I was there. I was recording. We were also filming. We're doing a film for PBS Frontline. And yeah, but I've been with many miners. There's another miner that I interviewed who would break into 10 or 15 minute coughing fits. Just the act of talking to me would cause, this was a female miner, by the way, a woman, would cause her to just go into these horrific coughing fits that literally lasted 10 or 15 minutes. Another miner who I interviewed for a story we did in 2016, who every word was followed by a deep breath. He had to suck in air to get the next word out. And it's only when you hear that, that you can really appreciate what a miner says when, you know, their lives are different now. I think that is such an important element of the journalism. And the description of the scenes, you mentioned me describing Danny Smith wearing sunglasses. The sunglasses hid the tears. In that scene, we're at a mine that he used to work at. It's abandoned now. And he's talking about how they had such promise and hope when he was a young miner, and they worked really long hours. And he's, you know, he's only, well, today's his birthday. He's 47 today. He's only 47 years old, and he's picked out his burial plot. He can barely breathe without oxygen. He has two daughters, one in college and one in high school. And he, you know, he worries that he may never see grandkids. He may never see them graduate. It's really important as journalists to capture those things as well as, you know, the facts and the data, and to do what we call accountability interviews, talking to the people who may have had some responsibility and talk to them about why they did or didn't do what they did.
I have questions about those accountability interviews in a moment. Let me stay with your sources a little further, though. If it is a struggle to say words, and if you as a 40-something-year-old man are crying, you know, these are such vulnerable moments. Did the fact that they were willing to put themselves out there and willing to go through this struggle, was that a sign to you that this has to be covered? This is a big deal. I mean, couldn't they have just said, no, I don't want to talk to a reporter?
Oh, plenty of people didn't want to talk to us. I've worked, I've done stories on and off in Appalachia about coal mine safety for 8 years. And I've been thrown off porches by the most polite people you can imagine. And I've had to work months to get people to talk to me. In this case, it took a lot of time to get trust built with people. It's much more common for somebody to say they don't want to talk. But when they see that you are interested in not only what they have to say, but in learning more about them, what's happened to them, why it's happened. You know, if you're just running in to do a quick hit interview, you're not going to get deep. You have to spend time with people, and they have to learn to trust you. The people who spoke with us because they felt that it was important that other people in this country hear about what has happened to them, and they have this hope that maybe it'll help other miners if they talk. It won't help them. They're going to die from this disease, but maybe it'll help other miners. That's what every one of them, you know, said to us. I hope this will help somebody. And when people, Danny Smith was not the only miner we spoke with whose own words brought them to tears, and whose descriptions of their lives brought them to tears. He wasn't the only one. I always tell people, you know, I pull the microphone away. I say, I'm really sorry. We can stop. And in every case, they said, no, you know, this is okay. It's okay. They feel it's important that the world knows what they're going through and what's happened to them.
Wait, Howard, can I stop it and pull the microphone away? I'm crying on this end that people are that brave, you know, looking beyond themselves and ready to step out for the next.
You know, in my experience, I've spent a lot of time in my career talking to people who are in dire circumstances, whether it's, Hurricane Katrina, having your home flooded and 30 feet of water and having to, you know, be on the roof and watching your friends or family members float away on another roof and never be seen again, or, you know, black lung, young kid watching two of his friends sink into a grain bin and die right in front of his eyes, soldiers returning from war with horrific stories, or family members of soldiers who aren't coming back. And in almost every case, there's always somebody who's like trying to protect them and keep them away, you know, from a reporter who wants to ask questions. And, you know, and when they don't want to talk, that's fine. You walk away and you honor that. But I have found that in most instances, people want to talk. They want to tell their story. They want others to know what has happened. They want to honor the loss of their loved ones. They want the world to know the story that took place. And so I'm not surprised that people tell these heart-wrenching stories. Even after meeting them, you know, maybe for even just a few minutes, nobody asks them the questions we ask them. Everybody, you know, treats them gingerly and, oh, it'll be too difficult to talk about. And in most cases that I encounter, people want to talk about these things. They want other people to know. And as journalists, it's our responsibility to convey as much as possible as part of that situation as we can. It's important for people to be given a voice. And often the people I'm talking to for these stories don't have a voice otherwise.
Let's talk about the revelation that came out, one of the revelations that came out in this piece from this week. And more coal miners are being diagnosed and younger. And one of the reasons is the silica dust that you referenced earlier, and the rock connection, that we're not just going after coal, but as we grind up all the rocks, that it's more of this toxic dust is being breathed. Who put that together? Did this investigation reveal that, or did like authorities know?
What we did was, and we did this, you know, we went back 30 years, we acquired 30 years of data from the Mine Safety and Health Administration, data that showed all of the coal mine dust reading, sampling taken by mine inspectors in coal mines, every coal mine in the country over the last 30 years, when mine inspectors are sampling the air for mine dust, and they test it for the content of that mine dust, and they sometimes test for the silica content of mine dust. There's a record of it. And so we acquired that record, and we looked at thousands and thousands and thousands and thousands and thousands of dust samples. And we put together, you know, we saw what patterns there were. And one of the things, and this is data that the agency had, and they had the ability to do this too if they wanted to. What we saw was that most of the time, the regulatory system worked in terms of keeping the level of silica at safe levels. But what we found was that the times that it didn't work were pretty significant. 21,000 instances in which coal miners were working in air that had silica that was beyond the federal health standard. There's a regulatory mechanism where when a mine has too much silica, then what they do is they lower the limit of overall coal mine dust that the miners can be exposed to, and then they test again to see if the mine meets that limit. And by doing that, that's supposed to bring down the exposure to silica at the same time, because overall mine dust includes coal dust and it includes silica. And this is the working theory and formula that's been used for 40 years. It doesn't work 9,000 times, or it didn't work 9,000 times, and that's what the data showed. And there have been recommendations going back to 1974 to not do it this way, to control directly for silica dust, not use a formula, but just measure it directly, and also to have a silica limit that's twice as tough as the limit that's been in place for the last 40 years. And those things were recommended. The agency, we also got internal documents from the Mine Safety and Health Administration going back more than 20 years, showing that they knew more than 20 years ago that there were clusters of advanced lung disease among coal miners, that silica was said to be the cause. In fact, they sent out warnings to the mining industry. Miners are getting sick with advanced disease. There's more exposure to silica. You need to do something about it. But what didn't happen was a change in how silica is controlled in coal mines. The limit wasn't toughened, and there was no separate regulation of silica. So the formula that wasn't working was, you know, continued to be in place, and it continued not to work thousands of times. And that could explain what we're seeing now, which is, by NPR's count, more than 2,000 miners now suffering from progressive massive fibrosis, the worst stage of black lung.
You are listening to Airtime on Aspen Public Radio, the conversations, questions, and issues that deserve more time. I'm Allison Bechtesh. I'm speaking today with NPR investigative reporter Howard Berkus. Last week, his 20-minute expose showed that the epidemic that is killing thousands of coal miners could have been stopped by regulators. So you do these interviews, and you get these real experiences, and you explain why this matters. This is people's lives. This is people's health. And then you go talk to the people who are in charge, and you ask them questions about how we could let this happen. Did you feel a need to balance this, that it wasn't like good guys versus bad guys, that maybe Mine Safety and Health Administration, that they were good people working hard too, and we should show why they didn't regulate and why they didn't measure more accurately?
Well, there's always an explanation. The explanation might be an excuse. It might be valid. You know, nobody at the Mine Safety and Health Administration ever woke up in the morning and said, I'm going to go out and kill a few coal miners today. I'm going to not, enforce the regulations so in 20 years they're going to die of black lung. That doesn't happen. What does happen is, in these agencies, is that there are lots of pressures on regulators. There's pressure from the parent agency, in this case, the Department of Labor. The Department of Labor may have its own agenda on, what the agency should be doing, what they should emphasize. There's pressure from the White House to the Office of Management and Budget. There may be political agendas that the administration has. There are other challenges going on, mine disasters, for example, in the case of mining, that they have to respond to. So on any given day, there's a lot they could be doing, and they have choices to make about what they're doing. You know, what we found is that they were not only aware that this was going on, and in some cases, there were attempts during the Clinton administration, there certainly were attempts to do something about it. But those attempts failed for one reason or another, the resistance of the mining industry, the political will not being there, lawsuits that got in the way, whatever it was. So, there may be an explanation so you can understand why it didn't happen. That doesn't mean it's any less of a failure, because in this case, the failure to do what seemed to be the right thing to do means that there are so many people now whose lives will be cut short and who are going to die horrific deaths. And, there were opportunities in every administration since the mid-1990s to do something specifically about silica, and it didn't happen. Whether the administrations were Democratic or Republican, didn't happen in the Obama administration. The Mine Safety Agency in the Obama administration actually did major things on controlling coal dust, coal mine dust in coal mines, but did not address silica. So you ask them why they didn't do it, and if they give you an answer that doesn't seem to make sense, hopefully you know enough about what you're talking about to know that, then you keep pressing. And so in some cases, it's not black and white. It's not like they're evil and they did something wrong. Often they did the best they could with the circumstances they had. But in this case, because we're talking about such a severe disease, there were so many signs. It's hard to find an excuse for not doing something, not only among regulators, but among the mining industry as well.
You have a couple of interchanges in the piece that show you asking the authorities, well, so are you going to attribute this to silica, or did you know? Why didn't you do anything? What was the idea behind including the entire question and answer tape all as one in those situations?
Well, again, I think this is part of something reporters should do. First of all, I know most of your listeners are not reporters, but for the reporters out there, always mic your questions. Because it's not just the answer that's important. Sometimes the question and how it's framed is equally important, and the response then becomes even more important. And in this case, So we have one scene where the Assistant Secretary of Labor for Mine Safety and Health, David Zetesloh, wouldn't talk to us, wouldn't do an interview. So we went to a public event where he was speaking. This is something he rarely does. And then we went up to him afterward to ask him questions. And it was somewhat of a confrontational situation because he didn't want to talk to us then there, and he kept trying to walk away. And so, you know, we asked tough questions and we persisted. And that exchange tells a lot about his approach to the policy, his discomfort with talking about it. So that's why it was important to keep that in there. There are other instances in which somebody said something and then I asked a question in response to that, which is part of sort of holding them accountable. And so you want to do that when it's relevant. I think it's an important tool for reporters to both show that they've asked the tough questions, but also the response of the person you're talking to tells a lot.
What ultimately do you find your duty to be, and how do you find truth in your reporting? And I ask that because you've had real consequences in once the story hits. So the story that hit this week about black lung and pointing to the people who are supposed to be regulating, you did something wrong. You know, there's action taken. But this is a beautiful story when you spoke with Bob Ebeling shortly before his death, and he shouldered a lot of guilt for the death of the Challenger astronauts. So he was an engineer as part of that.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
And he told you that, and that story goes out into the world. And the ultimate result was the listeners writing in and saying, Bob, it's okay. You know, like kind of giving him some of that relief right before his death. I mean, that is an amazing action taken by many on part of what you do. So do you have that in the back of your mind? Like, are you hoping for specific actions? And is that correct of a reporter to hope for that?
It's a mistake because you never know what's going to happen in response to your reporting. And the Bob Ebeling Challenger story is a really good example. Bob Ebeling was one of our confidential sources more than 30 years ago in 1986. He was one of two engineers who spoke to us and told us what, you know, really happened with Challenger. And he remained confidential until the 30th anniversary. And I kept in touch with him over the years. I knew what was going on with him in his life and how that had affected him and how the guilt continued. And when the 30th anniversary of Challenger came around a couple of years ago, just on a hunch, I decided to call him up, you know, again, see how he was doing and see if he was willing to talk about it. I knew he was, you know, in his 80s. And, you know, I thought maybe he had some reflection that would be really interesting to hear. And I was really shocked when he said, sure, come on up. I was really shocked because he'd turned me down so many times over the years. I had no idea what he was going to tell me. I had no idea what kind of impact it would have. And that interview was astonishing because nothing had changed in 30 years. He still felt as much guilt as he had 30 years ago. He blamed himself for not doing more, for not convincing NASA to stop that launch. He blamed himself. He didn't blame NASA. You know, he blamed himself. And that was a heavy burden of guilt. And his wife and daughters, you know, told me how that had really affected his life. And I knew that anyway, because I'd kept in touch with him. And, you know, we did a quick turnaround story that aired on the anniversary. It was a short piece. You know, one of the things he said to me was that God, he's a religious man, and God made a mistake in having him be there that day. And when people heard that, that's what triggered the response. Hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of people wrote in, and some of them figured out where, you know, he lived and, you know, tried to call and send postcards and stuff. Many of them saying, it's not your fault. You did what you were supposed to do. Many of them were engineers like him, saying the role of an engineer is to provide the information and argue as best you can, but you're not the decision maker. That's not your responsibility. And so I went back to him, you know, and he, at the time, his eyesight was no longer good enough for him to read. So I would read him some of these emails and letters, his daughter would, and none of it made a difference to him. So I said, well, what would? And he said, well, I've never heard from Morton Thiokol, the contractor that he worked for, and I've never heard from NASA. So I got in touch with some of the people who were involved in the launch decision at Thiokol and NASA. they wouldn't talk to me on tape, but one from Thiokol, one from NASA called him and said, it's not your fault. And then, you know, I went to NASA and I said, do you have anything you might want to say? And they wouldn't go on tape either, but they issued a statement basically saying the space program needs more people like Bob Ebling who are willing to stand up for the safety and the lives of astronauts. You know, I'm paraphrasing. And when we read that to him and he got those phone calls from the other folks, that made all the difference. And when I read the letter from NASA to him, he actually raised his hands above his head and he clapped and he said, bravo, and he smiled. And I had never seen him smile in the 30 years that, you know, I'd been in touch with him. I'd never seen him smile like that. And he smiled, and that did it. That did it. And he died 3 weeks later. And his daughters said to me, you know, that those 3 weeks, he finally had let go of that guilt. He finally was able to let go. So, you know, NPR listeners are the best, you know. And that's not the first time that's happened. I did a story once about a soldier, an older soldier who volunteered to go to Iraq, owned a ranch, a wife and two daughters in Colorado, goes off, you know, his like second day, an IED hits him. He suffers a very severe traumatic brain injury and their lives are kind of ruined. And I did this story about how the medical care system in the Army wasn't set up to deal with these soldiers who were part of reserve and National Guard units or who weren't at military bases. And it was a huge, you know, financial burden and medical burden on him to get the care he needed. And I talked about the burden, and they were going to lose their ranch. They weren't able to keep up with their mortgage payments and stuff. After that story aired, somebody stepped forward and paid off their mortgage. We have, you know, amazing, listeners and, you can't go into a story thinking that's what's going to happen. You just tell the story and, you know, maybe it'll make a difference and maybe it won't.
Howard, from these individual lives that you've impacted in such a great way to the thousands of coal miners who now have you to thank for bringing light to a very hidden situation, I have to thank you for all your years of reporting and ask you how much longer we get you for.
Well, officially a couple of weeks, but I'm still working on a frontline documentary that also is focused on the black lung disease story, and that's going to air on January 22nd. And there's some amazing film in there, and the filmmaker is an Academy Award nominee from West Virginia, Elaine McMillian Sheldon, who's a fabulous filmmaker. So I encourage people to watch that. I'll be working on that probably, you know, into January. And you know, after that, I'm looking forward to skiing during the week, kayaking, going into the canyons in Utah during the week when it's not crowded. And, you know, just I'm not interested in deadlines anymore, but who knows?
Howard Berkus, investigations correspondent for NPR, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you. It was great talking to you about my career and about these important stories.
Thanks for tuning into Airtime on Aspen Public Radio. I'm Allison Bektesh. Each week, Airtime brings you conversations with the people and ideas that deserve a little more time. You can podcast or stream this show online, aspenpublicradio.org. Airtime is a production of Aspen Public Radio News.